Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. Thank you, everyone, for your patience. It's been quite a while since the last time I came and published a full episode, but this is it. We're back. I'm back into the recording. I'm pretty much completely settled in Chicago. Well, not completely settled, but settled enough that I'm back into regularly recording and making interview requests and looking at who I'd like to talk to. And this week, we have on our podcast an exciting guest, which was a little bit of a chance encounter. Some of you who play board games might be familiar with the tabletop show. And if you're not familiar with it, I recommend you checking it out. You can check it out on YouTube, generally speaking. You can look on YouTube. It's a TV show or web video show, rather, from Wil Wheaton, who you might be familiar with from Star Trek The Next Generation, who played in a bunch of other movies. In any case, they organize an event called International Tabletop Day. And I found out about it because they were probably targeting me through Facebook, given I mentioned that I like games. So I came across it on my timeline. And I went to an event at the public library downtown Chicago and met with Randy, who was playtesting his board game. The board game is called Scoundrels, and it's a pirate game. And it was a lot of fun, frankly. It was a lot of fun. Randy happens to work out of the Cards Against Humanity office in Chicago, so that's where we recorded. I got lucky enough to be invited over there to get a tour and record in pretty much, well, the most professional facilities and most professional recording equipment that I've ever used. Given this show is pretty homegrown, I'm in the process of shipping over some of my stuff from London, so I only have like a tiny Samsung Go mic right now to record this. And as you said, it's pretty amateurish. But we're getting better at it. And the first thing is to get back on track with publishing on a regular basis. So that's my main priority. So Randy is a game designer. He's worked on a variety of different mobile games, video games, as well as the board game that we talk about during the episode. So talk about his inspiration, talk about how we got into gaming, talk about some of his recommendations for people who are interested in getting into a career in gaming. And we really had a fun conversation overall. So I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. We talk about a bunch of different movies. And don't forget, if you enjoy the show, you can give the show a rating or review. If ever you give the rating or review on iTunes, so that's on your podcasting app or on iTunes if ever you're on your laptop or computer. If you enjoy listening, every single 5-star review helps other people find the show. Of course, I'm going to catch up because it's been quite a while since the last time I published, but I'm still around. Don't forget you can find all the other things that I published, such as the Ice Cream Sunday newsletter on my main website. That's at www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything spelled out, icecreamforeveryone.net. And you can also find all the previous episodes of the podcast. And if ever you want to ask me a question, you can email me at Willem, Willem, @icecreamforeveryone.net, or you can contact me on Facebook. There's the Ice Cream for Everyone page. There's links to that from my website, or you could just like type in Facebook and find it. You can also contact me on Twitter. That is ICVillem. The letters I, letter C, Willem, Willem. And that's about it. Hey, Randy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for having me after like a long hiatus. I'm just getting back into things and I couldn't have believed that I have such an amazing environment to be recording in to get back into things in Chicago.
I'm glad to welcome you.
Yeah, thank you. So do you want to tell us where we are?
We are hanging out in the podcast studio, one of the podcast studios for the Cards Against Humanity office. I am an independent game designer and I work out of this space.
Yeah, which is fantastic. It's a really gorgeous space. And I believe they moved here, you were just saying, like a couple of years ago. They designed it entirely.
Yeah. So Cards Against Humanity used to be based out of, you know, their own little office like anywhere else. But then they've, as you might have guessed, been pretty successful. So yeah. They had this place built. Well, not built. It's an old building. They had it renovated, I want to say at the end of 2014, early 2015. And it's It's great.
Yeah, it's a beautiful co-working space. So there's like a number of other people and projects and companies that are working with them in the same space, right?
Correct. Yeah. So it's just a lot of, you know, there are tech nonprofits here. There are designers, artists, illustrators. I am one of them, and I'm just kind of lucky to have been to have gotten that opportunity.
Yeah, great. And so, so we met. What was it? Like last month, a few weeks ago for Tabletop Day, right?
Correct.
Yes, yeah. At the Chicago Public Library. So for everybody, and Tabletop Day. Well, just for context, actually, was organized by Will Wheaton and his video show Tabletop. Right.
Right. I want to say the very beginning of International Tabletop Day.
Yes, International Tabletop Day. Sorry, I forgot the international. I don't know which other countries it really happens in, but...
No idea. Probably France. I don't know.
I would imagine if there was anything to do, like... But, I mean, there's a lot of gaming occasions in France, as you know. I mean, I don't know if you know, actually. I come from France.
Yeah.
All right. So we were at the Chicago Public Library and I got to play test your game and we got chatting. And so that's why I thought it would be great to have you on the show. But starting at the beginning, I guess, just for a bit of, just background, where are you from?
I am from the South Bay area in California, about, 40 minutes south of San Jose in a town called Gilroy.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Great. And, the gaming side of things, how did you get into gaming? Was that something that of a passion that was always there, or what do you remember around that?
Yes. I have always planned on making games. It was kind of, I actually made that decision in fifth grade, using the Warcraft 2 map editor.
Oh, really?
So it shipped on the, you know, the same CD-ROM with the game.
I remember that.
I didn't even own Warcraft 2. It was my friend across the street who was showing me the game and then said, oh, yeah, it has this map editor. Yeah. And I said, can I borrow that CD-ROM?
And just to check for listeners, not in the U.S. and for myself, to be honest, fifth grade, you're what, like 6, 7 years old, something like that?
Or how old are you? Eight, that, nine? It would have been... 10 or 11.
Okay, 10, 11 years
old.
So
it would have been, Warcraft 2 came out in 96, I believe.
Yeah.
And I think I was playing it that year or the year after. So.
What's the first video game you remember playing or remember encountering, like coming across?
I have vague memories of playing Donkey Kong at a family event when I was probably 4 or something.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really actually play a ton of video games when I was really young, and my parents didn't let me have a console.
Uh-huh.
So they were, you know, they used the rationale that it's going to destroy the TV. So.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
So you had to go play at friends' places?
Yeah, there was definitely a bit of that. And I think, you know, Warcraft 2, like encountering that map editor.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I think it kind of changed what I was thinking about with games.
Okay.
You know, the idea that you can, you know, click and drag your mouse and leave like a swath of trees was super exciting.
Yes. So how did that, so like you got the CD from your friends, mm-hmm. you got onto the map editor.
Yeah.
And what happened from there?
Well, very foolishly, I thought editors back then were not very... comprehensive, like mm-hmm. they weren't. So I made a map in the snow style because I love the winter maps. I think everyone loves, you know, like the good snowy trees. And I designed a map where you were supposed to rescue an elf because they had neutral characters in Warcraft 2 that if you, you know, got near them, they would become part of your party.
Yes. And just to make sure for anybody who has not played this, because like not everybody who's a gamer is going to be listening to this necessarily. So can you remind us Warcraft 2? So it's a real-time strategy game, right?
Right, exactly. So it's almost identical sides of the orcs versus the humans. And except for a couple special units, you build bases, you get resources from mines, you chop down trees, build bases, build units, and then send those units against your...
Which, come to think about it, like, actually almost everybody listening today will be very familiar with that on the kind of mobile variants that there are, like Clash of Kings or...
Is it Clash of Clans?
Clash of Clans. Sorry, yeah. I'm really bad.
I believe Clash of Kings might also be one of those.
So yeah, I don't really play them, but the principles are the same. What they've added since then is a lot of the kind of wait time based mechanics to encourage you to pay more money in, but building bases, building armies, etc. There's actually a lot more people that are going to be familiar with that style of game today, I guess. I don't know what you think, but
I think from just a non-gamer standpoint, I think that's probably pretty accurate. I don't really play those types of games, so I'm not... I think the mechanics of the actual war is simpler, but they do have like this major base building mechanic, and a lot of asynchronous play is kind of the hallmark of those modern ones, whereas, you know, I want to say the asynchronous play is kind of a hallmark of modern game design, whereas those early games, it was very much you are playing against that person. Like right now, at the same time, you're both fighting with units and who can do it more intelligently, more quickly.
All right, cool. And so the map editor, you like got onto a big enterprise of building ice maps so that were basically for your friends to play on.
It was perhaps more of just the enjoyment of creating space, you know, like I really like, thinking about, you know, spaces, and if I weren't in games, I'd probably have been an architect. And so it was just kind of a hobby where it would be, you know, then StarCraft, the big sequel from Warcraft 2, came out, and I started using that editor and started making campaigns with that. And it was a much more fleshed out editor than the Warcraft 2 one.
I remember that one, actually. I did use it a little bit as well. I had vast ambitions to be creating my own maps, and most of them are unfinished,
to be honest. I have to say the same thing. Like, I have very few very few finished maps for any of those things.
The my ambitions and, like, what I had laid down on paper and, like, seeing how, like, original missions from the game compared to what I was able to achieve was, not the same. Even though you have all the tools to be able to do that, I don't know, did you spend a lot of time creating and putting them together in a way that was, that they were playable then, or?
Yeah, definitely. And I was really into the kind of storytelling aspect of it, kind of trying to create some sort of mood, trying to create some sort of prerogative to play through those maps. And I think you found, with real-time strategy and a lot of the very popular game editors, you find kind of a dichotomy of people who are making single-player things where they want to tell a story versus other people who are trying to make multiplayer things. So a lot of people, when they're working on StarCraft, they're making a multiplayer thing. They're saying, I want to make a map that I can play with my friends.
Right.
And I was often kind of tinkering by myself on, I want to make an experience. It's not about playing with other friends. It's about me, like, giving you this experience.
Got it. Interesting. And so what were some of your main inspirations to be either creating the maps or any other video games that you were thinking about at the time, I guess, early ages?
That's a good question. I think even as early as, like, when I was playing StarCraft, and that would have been junior high, I was thinking about things like corporations taking over and becoming bigger things than countries, you know, learning about things like multinational corporations. So those were kind of interesting spaces to explore. I don't know that I was quite there. I think I was still probably trying to emulate other games I was playing.
Sure.
Or, you know, I was a big Tolkien fan.
Right.
Reading also Heinlein, you know, sci-fi, fantasy. I don't know. It's I think just probably absorbed what most people were absorbing as a kid.
All right. So. And then junior high and high school, what kind of music were you into then?
I was actually really bad about knowing anything about music until probably, it was over the course of high school. I started to discover, modern bands. Mm-hmm. I grew up with like the oldies.
All right.
That was what was playing. You know, I definitely discovered ska when my sister's boyfriend at the time was like in a ska band. So a lot of that stuff. But I do have explicit memories of working on games, listening to Rage Against the Machine, and Red Hot Chili Peppers. So
cool.
Yeah.
And so throughout, were you always like, so you still had, you were set already on the fact that you wanted to make games at that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were working on things on the side to study it? What kind of things were you studying then? Or what did you have as ambition for that?
Well, so everything that I was reading at the time very much kind of pushes you towards having a hard skill. Mm. And I think, you know, a lot of things still kind of pressure people in the game industry, learn a hard skill, you know, learn coding or learn art or learn something that someone can hire you to do as a junior person. You know, if you want to be a designer, everyone has design ideas. Mm-hmm. It's like a very common story that kind of gets pushed. Mm-hmm. It's you're not a designer. Very few people are designers. Learn to be an artist or a coder. And I was lucky enough to have, there was a 3D graphics course at my high school that was taught by the AutoCAD teacher. Like the guy who taught architectural drafting uses very similar software.
Yeah.
And so I started taking that. And I was never a good artist. I liked drawing.
Mm.
But when I got my hands on like a 3D modeling program, everything started to make sense.
Mm.
So I really embraced that and just worked a lot on 3D and animation and was learning all these things about just kind of modeling and timing. And, you know, I was in band. So a lot of my early animations were to the songs that we would play in like the, you know, the orchestra.
Right. So. Right. That's cool. And so, because it's usually said that, like, because I had ambitions to be working in video games back in the day as well, and a lot of people were telling me that you need to learn to draw. Mm-hmm. And I actually worked in an agency early days where I was doing office interior, so I worked with AutoCAD and with 3D Studio Max a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I never quite passed going from moving, like, creating furniture to organic or things that had a lot more curves to it.
Yeah.
How did you like, or can you speak to that part?
I can speak to that in that, I enjoyed low polygon modeling. Mm-hmm. I like, the frugality of saying, okay, you only have this many polygons to work with.
Can you just explain a little bit just for the people who don't know how it works?
Yeah, sure. So 3D models, like if you see a character in a 3D game, mm-hmm. If you see, you know, a Pixar film or anything like that, when you get down to it, that is made up of a big three-dimensional mesh of triangles, you know, that create a skin or, you know, like a box is made up of, 12 triangles, you know, each side is made up of. So triangles is the way computers calculate 3D,
mm-hmm.
and they put a surface on that each triangle. And so low poly modeling basically means you're trying to use as few triangles as possible. And when I was first getting into games, you know, the number of triangles that a computer could compute was growing rapidly. And, you know, by the time I was in college, you could have a character in a game with probably a couple thousand triangles.
Mm.
So it's not really low counts anymore, but there's always technology that's not as advanced.
Yeah.
Something like a mobile game where maybe you do want to try and get something in 100 polys, 100 triangles. So I just really enjoy it. You're literally moving each corner of those triangles to find how can I make a character out of this?
Yeah. And do you, did you like draw any more later on or sketching or did you get any better at it or?
Yes. Through the aid of others who started to teach me, you know, what I should be kind of pushing on. So when I was, I went to college for 3D animation. Like it was clear to me that this was something I wanted to do. I looked for a university that offered more than just general art. And then found a 3D animation program at a Northeastern University in Boston.
Okay.
And one of my classmates, roommates, is an amazing illustrator. And so, you know, I would end up sketching something and he would give me advice on it.
Great. And did you have around that and ever since any other ambitions for the kinds of games that you wanted to work on?
Yeah. So game design for me is like a very philosophical thing, I guess. That's arrogant. I think that's, I'm saying that I'm like, let's back up there. I didn't go into games with the intent of trying to make one type of game or any particular thing. It was game design and the systems of games, I think, is an endlessly fascinating subject because it brings together most, you know, any medium of art that you want to, you know, whether it's visual or auditory, you know, film, storytelling, all of those stuff, all of those things can exist within games, and all of the ways you can interact with games exist, you know, whether it's an individual game, you know, computers have allowed us to make solo games. Historically, games are, you know, a group activity, or maybe one-on-one. And so just there's so much there where you're just kind of like, what does it mean to be a game?
Yep.
So
have you studied or come to, like, do you have a particular approach around that? Or
yeah, I think that I usually come into something with what is the constraint that I'm like dealing with at the moment.
Yeah.
So the game I'm working on right now, I'm working on a mobile game called Seldom Falls that is kind of, it's not Match 3, but it kind of turned into it a little bit. And it was, there were several constraints. One, I originally wanted it to only take a couple weeks. It's now month 8. I wanted it to be playable in portrait mode. So that's kind of one of those things when you're making a mobile game, you know, like the, if you tell someone, oh, you have to turn your phone sideways, then you're suggesting, oh, you need to use two hands now. If you make a portrait mode game, you're suggesting, hey, I'd like to make something where you can hold it in your hand while you're like also holding onto a railing in a subway. And then the other constraint was just I had drawn a picture of this little town beneath a waterfall, and I was thinking about how could I make a game that's about environment? How could I make a game about nature and like dealing with kind of, well, I didn't know what at that point.
Right.
But it ended up being, okay, I want to make a game about this town that I sketched, and how can I evoke a mood in this little sketch? Like, how can I make it so that you're excited to open up this game and feel like there's a little town in your pocket? You know?
Great. So. And so, well, across the show, you've worked on a number, you've worked on a number of games projects along your career, I would imagine. Do you have a proudest or favorite kind of moment, whether it's a particular game or a project or anything else that you've worked on?
Sure. Yeah. So I have a couple games probably that would be my proudest on different axes. So right after college in 2009, I became, I ended up working for a Facebook game company for a year. But right before that happened, I got a random little gig with this indie team that definitely had some cred going into it. You know, like a couple of the people working on it had done cool things, but they were breaking out and trying to make an iPhone game. You know, it was Gold Rush time of the iPhone. Mm. And it was called Spider, the Secret of Bryce Manor. And they didn't have any money. And they basically said, if you come in and, you know, like if we make any money, you'll make some money. Mm. So I came in and did some art for them, you know, like I did like the icon and like tutorial art, like arrows pointing to things and a couple levels. And the game did quite well. And so a year later, I quit my Facebook game job to work on their next title, which was called Waking Mars. And that's probably my proudest in terms of kind of an innovative, interesting storytelling game where I was kind of the senior artist slash tech lead helping just a small team of a few people by placing all the spread. I was kind of the one who was getting the art into the game and coming up with the broad ideas and working with other artists who would then, you know, take the like little sketches that I was just getting into the game. They would then like really improve upon those things and make beautiful pieces. And I was kind of that like connection. Mm. And that was great. So that was probably one just like in terms of the game, I think it was very meaningful.
And what type of game was it? Sorry.
It's on everything at okay. this point. It's it was originally a mobile game. It was really good on like tablets. Waking Mars. It's a side scrolling game.
Okay.
Where you are, it's kind of Metroidvania.
Okay.
So to explain to people, it's got levels. However, those levels kind of expand and open more doors to more levels. And as you, you know, like you end up having this massive cave system. Mm. The premise of Waking Mars is that you are exploring a cave system under the surface of Mars after extraterrestrial life has been found.
Okay.
But the angle is that it's very sciencey. Like it's not about rockets, you know, rocket launchers or anything. Okay. It is you are trying to cultivate these ecosystems of life that you find.
Well, all right. So it's like there's adventure slash puzzler things a little bit.
Slash
something else.
slash ecosystem. Jetpack gardening.
Jetpack gardening. That's a good term. That sounds quite exciting.
Yeah.
Great. That's very cool. And the game did well?
Yeah, that game did well. So we did decently on, you know, mobile, and then about 6 months later it came out on Steam, like PC and Mac and Linux, and the combination of those two things, you know, it's still kind of, it's not like a major title that people, you know, automatically know, but yeah, very proud of that one.
And were you already in Chicago at that point, or?
No, I haven't released anything meaningful since I've been in Chicago. I've only lived in Chicago 2 years.
Okay.
So.
And that, so at the time, were you still in Boston or San Francisco or Bay
Area? I was living in the Bay Area. At that point.
All right, cool.
Although most of the team was actually in Austin.
Okay.
So Tiger Style Games was the group behind that.
Got it. And so all this time, were you also working on, not working on, but like, did you have other types of games and formats, like either, you know, tabletop, board games, card games? Did you play other kinds of games or not so much?
Yeah. I think I first discovered board games, I think, as kind of like a meaningful pastime when I was interning at my first real game company. Mm. And they had like a Thursday lunchtime, we play board games. Mm. And I played Robo Rally, which I was just like, this is incredible. I think we played Bang and Cash and Guns. And one of the designers there had used to run a comic slash game shop. So I went, you know, a couple times over to his place and played, you know, like deep, like 8 hour, like role playing games.
Uh-huh.
So I had that experience, and I had friends in high school who were into like Warhammer.
Cool.
So I played those things.
And the role playing games you were playing over there, what was the titles? What were the titles? Sorry.
Descent, or I don't know. Role playing is probably.
It's okay. So, all right. So that's Descent is kind of like a bit of a mix, right? It's got a board. It's got the figurines, but it also there's adventures, and you're following a certain. Do you own a character in it? I can't remember.
Yes.
Yeah, you do, right?
Yeah, and that was now. Oh man, that was probably 9 years ago now that I've played that. So yeah. I don't remember a whole lot of details about it.
It's okay.
But I know, and I've been meaning to play the Star Wars, I want to say Imperial Assault.
Yeah.
Is a derivation of that.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I know of the game, but not as an expert either. So it's kind of the same thing. I think it's a little bit the same. All right, cool. And what other sources of inspiration do you think are particularly useful to you in creating games and working on your art?
Probably exploring, like hiking and getting outside, and riding my bike around and traveling like that. I kind of grew up with the bike as the central activity that I had, you know, like I lived in a town that was kind of great for biking and that you could ride a mile and you would now be kind of on the edge of town. And so suddenly you could start to go like up into the hills if you wanted to. And we had like a really great kind of park levee / kind of wilderness esque park on the edge of town. And I would spend a lot of time there. And I think just kind of like thinking about moods, you know, thinking about things you want to evoke, thinking about things you care about. And so I don't like if I'm starting to make a new game, I like to think specifically about the constraints. Like I like to think about, okay, what am I making a game for and what is the thing that I can get out of that?
Yeah. Yeah. Got it. Great. And so we met and you were working on a board game as well.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So Scoundrels is a 3-6 player board game. It's a pirate game. It's very like I tell people it's kind of Mario Kart-esque and, you know, the leader will not end up the leader. And that was you use a hand of action cards, swords, sails, and cannons. And the idea is that on your turn, you do as much as you can, you know, like you sail to a port and then you attack the port and you get treasure from the port. But then you spent most of your cards. And so the person next to you comes in and spends their cannon cards to shoot you and then spends their sword cards to come aboard and take your treasure.
Yeah.
So.
And I got to play that with a few other people and play test it. And I thought it was a lot of fun at the stage that we were at. You've been working on that for about how long, approximately?
A long time.
Long time.
Probably about 4 years now. Or
yeah.
Five years. That was inspired because I needed to get away from making games on the monitor.
Mm.
You know, I was spending just all my time. Computers are bad for our vision.
Yeah.
So that was one of two inspirations.
Yeah.
The other one was I had found this great little game called Dread Pirate when I was in college. I had gotten it on one of these Barnes & Noble like red sticker sales for like $10. And I played it and like the concept was great and it felt nice. But the mechanics were just very simple.
Hmm.
You know, it was clearly Dread Pirate is made for parents and their 8-year-olds.
Right.
You know, like you win the treasure by rolling dice. You win battles by rolling dice. You figure out how far you go by rolling dice. But it had such this wonderful kind of open world of maps, you know, like of ports and ocean. And I really loved that. And so when I decided I wanted to make a board game, I kind of had that in my back pocket where it was like, people haven't done a pirate game the way I would love.
Yeah. So. There's some of what I thought about when I was playing, which we didn't talk about. And it just occurred to me again now, which is the, there was a Zelda game where you're like
Wind Waker.
Yes. Wind Waker. Exactly. Okay. Yeah. And, was it the N64? No.
That was GameCube.
GameCube. That's right. I'm sorry. Yes. It was on the GameCube.
Yeah.
It was on the GameCube. And I really enjoyed that where you have a boat and you're going from island to island and it has like a quite cartoonish design to it. And like, while it's not at all the same thing, it's like the vibe of exploration going to from island to island was a little bit, I don't know, it's not the same probably, but it just made me think of that in terms of the blue and the islands and going along on your boat.
Definitely. And I think there's a very like idyllic version of pirates that I think a lot of us have like grew up with.
Yeah.
Right. If you watched, you know, any Miyazaki of like Porco Rosso or something like that, or, you know, I grew up like going to Disneyland and the Pirates of the Caribbean was very like that evokes something. And even though it's kind of terrible, like as soon as you get into it at all, like that concept and like Robert Louis Stevenson, any of those things. I did Treasure Island in elementary school. I was in a play of Treasure Island.
Yeah. Which role did you have?
The blind guy. What is the blind pew? And I was the one who like handed the black spot to. I don't remember.
I can't remember.
But that is a mechanic in Scoundrels, is the black spot, because it's just such an idyllic thing. It's like it's so ludicrous and kind of fun in the cursed nature of it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Just even the term like cursed.
Yes.
Right? It's not cursed. It's cursed.
Yes.
So.
Well, it's and pirates have been like very popular in the last few years, and actually it might be. I mean. A little bit stereotypical, but I can't help but think that there's another Pirates of the Caribbean movie coming out.
Yeah.
What, how do you feel about that?
I stopped watching after the second one, I think.
Yeah.
So I don't have strong feelings about it. I think, you know, at a point it became formulaic. Like it didn't have the same kind of, it just didn't thrill me.
I agree. And as much as I really enjoyed the first one, and now it's just... Well, it's a franchise and a series that doesn't really hold much interest in watching whatever's going on, I don't think, anymore. Yeah.
I have no idea what... I mean, they could still be good, but...
I don't know. I actually did... I tried watching the last one, I think, in a plane, and even in a plane, I didn't... Mm-hmm. I think I watched like 20 minutes or 30 minutes, and I was like, that was it.
Well, there's a lot of feelings I have about blockbusters of the last 15 years. You know, I overwhelmingly don't find much to like about them because they feel like they're all just going for this roller coaster effect.
Yeah.
And in a way that if you turned the camera 90 degrees, would there be anything there?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how I feel about it. And so I don't like there's a lack of depth.
Yeah,
it feels like.
Yes. And do you have let's start with a favorite pirate movie perhaps from any time?
Oh, I actually haven't watched it.
Okay.
I don't think I have one.
All right, well, how about an example of a counter example to what's going on in blockbusters these days? Anything that you'd recommend in, you know, past, I don't know, 5 to 10 years or even 15, whatever, that has impacted you in a way that the blockbusters and the popcorn movies don't necessarily anymore?
Right. That's a good question. I don't watch a ton of movies these days. I'm rewatching Twin Peaks.
Okay.
We didn't finish it the first time because it got really bad about halfway through the second season, but I've been really wanting to watch the new one, and I watch a lot of Netflix.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Yeah. I am rewatching Deep Space Nine.
Excellent.
Or not rewatching. I watched Deep Space Nine when it was on UPN as a kid, like, you know, the reruns. But when you're watching it on TV, you might miss an episode here or there. And so I've never like gone through the series proper.
Yeah. I got the same thing. Actually, I watched a bunch of them and I started going through it. I think I watched the first season, but years ago. And then I had seen like same as a kid, like a few episodes here and there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I Deep Space Nine. I remember being really interesting, clearly having an arc. And that was exciting to me. And there's, you know, this kind of whole, like there's this underlying theme of the Dominion War kind of going on where while you're having these kind of character arcs.
Yeah.
And I was really into that, and I am now about halfway through the final season.
So. Still holds together, right?
Or, it's great.
Yeah, yeah, I think so.
And like any show, there's plenty of bad episodes. And there's, you know, one of the ones that I watched recently. It's really corny where there it's just about a baseball game between the DS9 crew and Vulcans.
Yeah.
and it is a corny thing, but, you know.
Yeah, still, there's a few of those here and there.
Yeah.
Space Station style. Have you watched Babylon 5?
I haven't seen Babylon
5. I highly recommend it. Okay. If you enjoy Deep Space Nine, and Babylon 5 is very, very good along the same kind of lines with multiple species, political issues, the space station at the center of multiple things going on in the universe. And it's really good. It's very, very cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've also heard that Farscape is really good.
It is. I've never watched the whole thing, though.
Okay.
I think I've watched the first one or two seasons, but that was a long time ago as well, and I don't remember all of it right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been trying to think of movies while we were talking about this stuff.
It's okay.
Yeah. I think I've been consoling myself with political, whenever I get too deep into politics news, I just go home and I turn on an 80s action movie.
Right.
So I watched Escape from New York just last month.
Uh-huh.
And that was fascinating.
Had you seen it before?
I had not seen
it. You had not seen it before. All right. No. Yeah. How was that?
I loved it. It was a weird movie. You know, it's just a space. It's very quiet.
Uh-huh.
You know, it kind of dwells in this weird feeling. You know, it's the beginning doesn't feel like it's trying to be a movie. The beginning feels like it's trying to just sit in this weird, uncomfortable, melancholy, surreal space. You know, there's something novel about it's New York City, but it's definitely not New York City.
Yeah. I just, funnily enough, I mean, I haven't seen Escape in New York in a long time. I've seen it a few times and I really like it as well. And have you heard of the podcast called How Did This Get Made?
Mm-hmm.
So they just recently, I don't know if they recently did that. I listened to it last week when they did the sequel, LA 2013.
Oh boy.
And it's a pretty cool episode where they basically, because the sequel is, they took exactly the same thing and they copied it almost to the letter, except that it's in Los Angeles rather than New York.
Mm-hmm.
This almost the same characters. It's the president's daughter again. it's exactly the same thing. And so they had a lot of fun, kind of pulling it apart.
Yeah.
And a couple of the people Jason Mantzoukas comparing it to, he was just revering Escape from New York while a couple of other people were hating it. So anyway, it's a fun episode.
Yeah.
Worth checking out.
Yeah. I like anything that kind of is pushing away from just that roller coaster.
Yeah.
Right. Which is why I was saying there was something novel about how surprisingly silent Escape from New York is.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something I hadn't really expected or known what to expect.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So. It's a whole, while talking, you were talking about moods earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's trying, or I think it succeeds as well at doing that pretty well.
Right.
About different moods in New York and, yeah.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly.
Yeah, and sitting in that mood is, you know, it's not going to work for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I definitely... under no impressions that it's going to work for everyone.
Yes.
But, you know, watch that. And then I watched The Killer. And that was also excellent.
Yeah, I've seen that a long time ago.
You have to kind of ignore some of the reasons people are doing things.
Yeah.
but in terms of an experience,
Yeah, cool. Great. And so what else? So these days you work for yourself and you work on contracting and freelance projects. Is that right? Or
that's right.
Yeah.
So I pay my bills doing art for other people.
Cool.
Unfortunately, I can't talk about
half
of those things. But, you know, I'm doing a 3D project right now for people, for one company. And I was doing game design consulting actually just a couple months ago. This is, you know, when I was talking earlier about needing that hard skill, any, you know, any career you do, like the more you do of something, the better you get at it.
Sure.
And the more people are likely to contact you about that thing. My goal was always game design, but my, you know, I was making money as an artist, and I'm still mostly primarily making money as an artist. But just starting actually last fall, I've now started game design consulting and, you know, making money as a game designer. And that was an incredibly rewarding kind of moment.
Sorry, just to make sure, like, what do you mean by consulting in that? So how does that?
Sure.
What does that look like? Yeah.
So it basically meant that I was brought on by a company that had a game that they wanted to update. They had released one version of it, and this has been mobile games. So like I've primarily, like my focus has been in mobile gaming since forever, like since before the iPhone. My first internship was at a company that made mobile games before the iPhone.
Yeah.
And so I've always enjoyed thinking about that stuff. And I was recommended to this gig by a friend who, you know, they contacted, said, we have this game. We would like to put a couple more months into it. You know, we have one version of it out, but we would love to, you know, spend some more time, figure out, can we get 30% more quality? And therefore, you know, like.
So working with the existing base and looking at how you could improve what was already there without changing everything.
Right. Yeah. So coming in and saying, okay, if you have 2 months, you know, like. Let's work on the story or, you know, like this mechanic here feels unnecessary and it's kind of diluting your experience. That was largely, you know, just kind of playing the game that existed, kind of sitting around thinking about it and then writing documents and PowerPoints. I learned this actually from the designer at Tiger Style, who does his game design documents are a very kind of popular thing in the game industry. And the idea is, you know, you're writing as much as you can out about the game. And it gets I have very mixed feelings about game design documents because, you know, once you start building something, it's going to teach you so much more about it.
Yeah.
And a game design document for bigger companies is often laying out literally everything because the time you're paying a programmer to build all these things, if you don't have everything laid out beforehand, you know, who knows what's going to happen on that way.
Right.
So, but that being said, you know, it's a consulting gig. So I'm there, you know, they have me just kind of write out these ideas. And then that particular one, I was literally going screen by screen, button by button,
right,
saying, okay, now when you click this thing, this is happening.
Right.
There needs to be a little bit of celebration here, you know, et cetera. And I was even, you know, writing text out because there wasn't I was like adding to the story. And so
that's great. Well, I think it's really interesting to know that for anybody either who works in gaming or who's interested in getting into it, that there's a lot of different avenues. You don't necessarily only have to, you know, like working for one of the big game giants, you know, the AAA, like Electronic Arts or like that is not the only avenue to be able to work in games necessarily.
I would say most people don't
work
for one of those.
Actually, that reminds me, talking it out loud, that there's I remember a documentary that was probably on Kickstarter about, I think it might have been called Indie Games.
Indie Game the movie?
Yeah, I think so, right? Yeah. Have you seen it?
I have seen it.
I have to check it out. Is it worth it?
It's good. It's kind of going to the extremes, you know, like it's talking to three big successful two game designers who are kind of working solo-ish, you know, and then one like duo, and it kind of covers the kind of stress of finishing a game and thinking but it's a really good way if you don't know anything about games. If you come into it you should know that it's coming into characters. Like, the people who are in that movie are characters, and like, they are they're the more outspoken people that you'll find in the game industry.
Right.
Like, a good chunk of people are not that outlandish as them. Okay. And those people definitely are being themselves.
Yeah.
I don't think they're like doing it up for the camera or anything.
Uh-huh.
But you know, it kind of makes it seem a little bit more extreme than it is.
Yeah.
But it definitely does play upon the constant nagging doubt that you have when you make something, you know, whether it's working or not.
Mm. Do you think that's like part of, isn't that part of any creation where you're making something, whether it's going to work and whether it's going to be successful, or that kind of concern? I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that I totally think that plagues anyone, especially when you're trying to make a career out of it.
Yeah.
You know, there's that weird thing of, you know, you don't want it to be about the money, but you kind of want to keep doing it.
Yes. And actually, I mentioned Kickstarter, and that's another thing I wanted to cover before we move on to the finishing questions, as it were. And like, you're in a lot of indie gaming, and I finance a bunch of like crowdsourced projects in gaming or board games that have gone from being able to have a game be successful to almost pre-ordering. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about what's going on in crowdsourcing? Do you think it's a necessary avenue for most games these days if you're an independent creator? Or
I'd say it depends heavily on whether you're making video games or tabletop games.
Okay.
A tabletop game, often when it comes to Kickstarter, is very far along, right? Mm. They're usually coming far enough along where they just need you to help fund the actual physical production.
Right.
And that stuff just costs a ton. And like, if anything goes wrong, it's thousands more dollars, you know, down the drain.
Yeah.
So I think Kickstarter has proven to be really good for tabletop games.
Mm.
On the video game front, I think it's a very different thing because a video game doesn't really cost anything to distribute. You know, there might be like marketing costs, but if you're doing it on Kickstarter, that is kind of your marketing.
Yeah.
The thing with a video game is you're coming there saying, I want to make a game.
Mm.
Like, and you're probably very early in the, you're early or midway through the process. Sometimes you'll see people like, hey, we just need money to help finish a game. But any time during the development of a game, that you could find out that something's completely wrong about it. You know, a lot of video games end up taking immensely, you know, longer, like way longer than they predict, just because you discover that you did something wrong.
Yeah. And then you have to rebuild everything, or yeah.
And so that's months of, you know, if you have a team of even like three people, right. If you have like four more months and then people happen to live like in a somewhat urban area, their monthly cost of living, like all these things very quickly, it could be $20,000-$30,000 just for something like that.
Yeah. Do you think you're going to be going to Kickstarter with your board game when you're ready? Or crowdsourcing in general, whatever.
Yeah, probably so. And I was already there once, and I was unsuccessful with Scoundrels. In 2015, I did a Kickstarter, and I spent about 6 months prepping for it, kind of like here and there, just kind of spending evenings kind of working on things. And I had a friend in manufacturing, like he works outside of games, but has, you know, dealt with manufacturing for his day job. And so he was kind of my advisor. And then I spent like a month and a half before the actual Kickstarter, pretty much working full time on it, got to 40% of the, you know, 35,000 that I think we asked for. And then it's just, it was not successful. And so I had to go back and find more work.
Yeah.
So,
got it. Yeah. All right. Well, good if you're trying it. I'm sure you learned a lot in the process.
You learn a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Well, just like, now we're going to be wrapping up, and usually wrapping up with some of the, what I call the cool down questions.
Okay.
And of course, it's the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast, so I got to ask some kind of ice cream related question. We're just going to go to the classic one. Do you have a favorite flavor to eat ice cream, or?
favorite would probably be cookie dough.
Uh-huh.
But I always get coffee ice cream.
Okay.
I think I'm like officially enough of a coffee addict that I just want to know what coffee ice cream tastes like whenever I encounter it.
Are you a coffee addict? Like, you know,
I have to have a couple cups, right? A day. Like I'm not.
But are you a connoisseur, of like specific kinds of blends and coffees and grinding your own beans? And
any quality of coffee.
As long as there's caffeine inside.
Yeah. Well, and I'm not picky. I think the thing is, I like a good cup of coffee. Like I totally appreciate like a really nice, you know, go to Intelligentsia or one of those places and like, oh, this is delicious or whatever. But I also am a big fan of what I call the gas station mocha, which is, you know, when you're like on a road trip and you stop in a random gas station and you do like 2/3 coffee from one of those, you know, dispenser things and then a third hot chocolate. So
very fancy.
Yeah, quite fancy for $1.19, you know.
Yes, absolutely. So. Cool. And what is going on in terms of gaming these days, either video games or other kinds of technology coming up that you're finding the most exciting?
Oh, boy. I don't like thinking about like the like cutting edge of technology.
Okay.
To me, that's not as exciting as about kind of exploring what's grounded. Mm-hmm. And I've also, but I think that like in terms of VR, it's pretty interesting to see what people are doing.
Okay.
Like, I don't really care about designing on that front.
Okay.
But I think that we're starting to see, you know, people really, there's a ton of VR stuff being created and people are kind of experimenting with, you know, what you can do in that. I don't think it's going to be commercially viable for a few years, cause it's just so expensive.
Yeah.
But VR is kind of the big thing. I'm most excited for when AR, so like the HoloLens, becomes a more viable thing versus VR.
Okay, got it. And overall, the conversations that I tend to have are really exploring creativity, creators, and inspiration. Do you have somebody that you'd say is one of your favorite creators? It could be an artist, it could be a designer, it could be anything, or any kind of creators.
Sure. I've been listening a lot to synthwave music lately. Okay. And there's this person, I believe it's a he, based out of Moscow, I think, called Moskva Cassiopeia. So if you like go onto SoundCloud and look up like MoskvaKai, like you'll probably
find it. I'll
get it
from you and I'll put it on the show notes as well and I'll check it out for sure. All right.
He has an EP that I really love and I've just listened to it over.
Is that the kind of stuff you listen to when you're working?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Without the lyric, you know, the lack of lyrics is good.
Interesting.
For working.
I completely agree. I found myself like over the past few years increasingly listening to instrumental types of music of all kinds. So either a lot of classical or a lot of jazz, blues, blues less so, but yeah, like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fantastic. Cool. Anything else you want to add? Like either where people can find you online or anything else that's coming up that people can watch out for?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Randy Zero. That's our Randy Zero spelled out Z-E-R-O. And my website is randyo.net. And you can see like the games that I've worked on and like the team projects and the individual projects. I do little weird things, and the game I'm working on now is just one of those that has expanded into a full thing.
Great. So. We'll be looking forward to it. I'll check it out and we'll put everything on the show notes. And thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thanks for letting me chat.
All right. Bye. All right, that's another episode wrapped up. The first, well, not the first of the second season, but it has been quite a few months anyway. I keep repeating myself. It's been a few months. You know it's been a few months. Thank you very much for listening the whole episode. Thank you very much for still being here. If you enjoyed it, how about like sending a link to a friend?
How about sharing it on social media, your favorite social network, wherever that is, may it be Facebook or whatever, Twitter. And if you have any feedback, questions, comments, I'd love to hear from you. If you have ideas of who I should be talking to, if you'd like to be interviewed for the podcast, if you have a particular perspective on creativity, on anything creative, on anything gaming, on anything design, strategy, like that, I'd love to hear back from you. So you can contact me on Twitter. As I said at the beginning of the episode, my username is ICVillain, at ICVillain, letters I and C and Villain, W-I-L-L-E-N. You can find everything else on my main website. That's at www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Post a comment on the Ice Cream for Everyone Facebook page. Contact me any way possible. And please leave a review for the show. It makes a hell of a difference for other people to find it. And I'll see you in a couple of weeks. I'm getting back into a regular publishing schedule and working so that I can publish episodes every other week. That's my goal at the moment. And until next time, have a great time. Bye.